This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people, the places, and the precipitation of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. We're taking a trip up the 101, past Ventura, past Santa Barbara, past Santa Maria, to a small hamlet called Arroyo Grande. More specifically, we are on a steep, muddy hill that looks out over the town.
Yeah, let me catch my breath. Woo. It is.
Shane Taylor is the utilities manager for the city of Arroyo Grande. He helped unlock the gate and shoo the cows away to trudge up this hill on a rainy day.
Here we are, satellite-based, solar-powered cloud seeding station operated remotely. It's amazing.
A cloud seeding station. That's what he's looking up at. A couple of tall silver towers with poles sticking out of them like tree branches.
And if it can help us draw some more moisture to help our watershed and get more water in the lake, do everything we can to try and get more water.
As drought continues across Southern California, we'll all take as much moisture as we can get. Despite the recent storms, the U.S. Drought Monitor says 85% of the state remains in severely dry conditions. And it's really hard to make a dent in the drought when it rarely or straight up just doesn't rain for 10 months out of the year. So cloud seeding tries to eke a bit more water out of the storms that do come. But does playing rain god really work? Here's KCRW's Catherine Barnes.
Up on the muddy hill with Shane Taylor, it's raining as we talk. But Taylor has the drought on his mind. He's thinking about a very empty Lopez Lake, just 8 miles east of where we stand. The reservoir is a lifeline for not only Arroyo Grande, but neighboring towns like Grover Beach, Pismo Beach, and Oceano.
It's about 28% full. It's not good.
28% is so not good that a sign at its boat launch says use at your own risk due to vessels bottoming out. And Governor Gavin Newsom chose this lake as his backdrop last summer when he announced water consumption cutbacks. Refilling Lopez Lake is where this cloud seeding station comes into play. Taylor stands and waits for a flare to ignite out of the metal tower.
Even though it's been a wet winter, or a couple of wet winters, there it goes.
Oh, there it goes.
No, it's not very noisy. But if you were here, you would see the poles start to burn. The flare is similar to the ones you see police officers ignite on the highway after a nighttime accident. As it burns, a plume of thick smoke emerges, containing silver iodide, billowing out and rising higher and higher into the sky. Usually, Taylor says he's not around to see this happen.
This is the first time I've ever seen one go off, so I'm serious. You're seeing this first time as me, so.
Hey, that's cool.
It is.
That's because the flares are triggered remotely by a meteorologist named Dave Yorty, sitting at a computer 800 miles away in Salt Lake City. He works for North American Weather Consultants, a company based in Utah that has a stronghold on the cloud seeding market throughout the American West. They're hired by water agencies in California, Utah, Colorado, and Idaho to literally make it rain, or at least make it rain a little bit more than it already is. The president of the company says they've seen a 20% increase in clients over the past 3 years, and existing clients are increasing their number of seeding sites. I'll let Yorty explain how cloud seeding works.
So it's taking cloud droplets that are below freezing, but they're still liquid because they're small. They don't freeze easily by natural processes, but if they have the right type of nuclei, which silver iodide is very good for, then it'll start the process of turning those into ice crystals, which will then grow into snowflakes and, you know, might fall as either snow or rain, depending on elevation.
If that's a bit too much scientific jargon for you, here's how I understand it. If you think of a storm cloud like a soggy sponge, cloud seeding tries to wring out as much of that water as possible. The silver iodide coming out of those flares helps bind cloud droplets together, making them heavier and more likely to drop. And Yorty's hope is they'll drop right onto the Lopez Lake watershed. The key word being hope.
I mean, one of the things about it is you don't see anything obvious. So you do your best to try to pick the right conditions, but it's not like you see anything obvious happening.
That's because cloud seeding occurs when there's already a storm in the forecast. Most of the time, it's already raining when the flares go off. So it's not like you can point to a raindrop and say, hey, that one dropped because of our silver iodide. That's why certain scientists are skeptical.
There's a long history of people making really bold claims about being able to manipulate the weather, and time again, science really has failed to demonstrate that these attempts to do that have actually yielded any fruit.
This is Daniel Swain, a climate scientist with UCLA and the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He says in traditional scientific experiments, you have a control group and a variable, and you compare the two outcomes to one another.
In the case of cloud seeding, it's very hard to design that control because the control is, well, what would have happened in the real world if you didn't seed, but to what extent are you observing the effects of seeding? To what extent are you observing the effects of random variations in weather patterns? It's extremely difficult to disentangle.
He points to the story of Charles Hatfield as a perfect example. In the winter of 1915, San Diego was in a really bad drought. The region was thirsty for water, and the city would try anything. So they hired Hatfield, who claimed he could make the skies weep. It actually inspired the 1956 Western film, The Rainmaker.
$100 in advance. Uh-huh. And inside of 24 hours, you'll have rain.
You mean it? Real rain?
Rain is rain, brother.
The real Hatfield headed deep into the woods and built a 20-foot tower near the banks of the Morena Reservoir. He mixed some chemicals together, set them on fire, and let the smoke drift upward. Shortly after the new year, several severe storms struck. The stone dam at the lower Otay Reservoir gave way. Floodwaters washed away homes, roads, railroad tracks. The drought was over, but more than a dozen people died. So, was Hatfield responsible for those deaths? Did he make it rain too much? Swain doubts it.
It's quite likely that what this person did essentially achieved nothing at all, and the drought-busting flood that followed were essentially a matter of chance.
Swain isn't saying that cloud seeding doesn't do anything. In fact, he points to some recent studies that estimate you can squeeze 3-5% more rain out of clouds. But it's never going to be a solution to the drought, or even a major contributor to the water supply. In other words, it's no silver bullet, or silver iodide bullet. And Swain brings up another concern, water equity.
To the extent that this may work and this may squeeze out, 5% more water from the clouds under certain conditions, are you doing that at the expense of how much it's raining or snowing in some adjacent region, which might also be experiencing the same drought that your watershed is?
Despite all these issues and concerns, more and more water agencies in Southern California are seeding their clouds. Some have been doing it for decades, like Santa Barbara. Others are just starting, like San Luis Obispo, which kicked off their third winter by paying North American weather consultants roughly $250,000 to set off flares at three different sites when the storm conditions are just right. That means the temperature's low, the winds are moving toward watersheds, and there's no risk of major flooding. And this past fall, a coalition of five water agencies in the Santa Ana watershed approved a four-year pilot that could benefit those living in San Bernardino, Riverside, Orange, and parts of LA. So the next time a drop of rain hits your forehead, just think, a guy behind a computer in Salt Lake City could have triggered it to land on you. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You've no doubt heard a lot about supply chain issues going on in this country and around the world. The ports of LA and Long Beach have ramped up getting products in from all over the place. But those products also have to be delivered, and truck drivers spend some grueling long hauls on the road making it happen. Some even live full-time in those big rigs driving across the country and keeping the supply chain moving. But aside from the old greasy spoons or truck stops that dot American landscapes, a trucker has to eat. And a lot of truckers actually cook their own food in their rigs. Everything from sandwiches to roasted yams to the beloved green bean casserole. New York Times reporter Priya Krishna looked into it, and she joins us now along with Christy Burton, a truck driver based out of Ohio. Welcome to you both. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Priya, you talked to several truck drivers for your article called A Holiday Feast Cooked in the Cab of a Truck. Tell us about some of the setups that these drivers have.
I was just absolutely amazed at the setups that people had. And, you know, when you look at a truck, the cab is just that small piece in the front. And in that, you know, people are growing herbs. They set up grills. They have slow cookers going. Some people even have sinks. Just the level of innovation was pretty amazing that I saw.
And the meals they're making, I mentioned the green bean casserole. I mean, we're talking like pretty innovative stuff too, I would imagine.
I was able to ride in the truck of one trucker. Her name was Dina McKinney, and she has a rotisserie in her truck that she was planning on using to basically make like a, you know, roast duck for the holidays. So, you know, there's really no limit to what, if you can make it in your kitchen at home, you can probably make it in a truck.
Christy, you run a Facebook group called Cooking in Your Semi-Truck. It has more than 4,000 members. Why did you make this group?
I actually came into the group about 3 months ago. It was actually Adrian who made the group. He needed a little bit of assistance, so I stepped up and kind of took over the reins to get more people in there and spread the wealth of knowledge that we have out here.
Are you in your cab right now?
I actually am, yes.
What do you have in there to cook with, and what are you preparing?
Okay, so my particular truck that I'm in right now, we're one of the lucky ones that do have a sink. Let's get that out of the way. We have a sink. We have a two-burner cooktop. We have a fry pan. We have a saucepan. And then we get into the more complicated stuff, like my husband's portable smoker that he carries with us so he can make brisket and all that sort of stuff. We have a, it's kind of like the 3-in-1 gallons microwave where you have the, you know, convection and the air fry, but ours is actually by Cuisinart. And that's pretty much all we need. And we can make some fantastic meals.
Is there, well, all right, so many questions here. Number one, you got to have water, right? You have a sink.
Yes.
Where do you get water into that sink?
So our truck has a 10-gallon water tank, and a lot of the times you have to hook up to the water at the truck stop. But with it becoming a little bit colder out here, my husband and I actually went to Harbor Freight and we bought a transfer pump. So we buy gallons of water, and we use the transfer pump to transfer it from the gallon bottles to our tank, and we're good to go.
All right, so you always have water.
Yep.
You need electricity. Obviously, you have a large battery on that truck in order to get the, no pun intended, the juice that's needed to make the food that you're making in there. And and the accoutrement, like as far as like the, you know, you're talking about this convection toaster air fryer contraption, you have those things. Do you worry about like a fire?
No, not at all.
Is there enough space? I mean, I've lived in some small, you know, hovels in my life with you know, really tiny kitchens. I can't imagine trying to cook in a cab.
You make it work. And the big thing is, you know, a lot of people need to realize with dealing with the porch shutting down or a lot of restaurants shutting down because of COVID, we had to make it work. So that's what we did.
You mentioned the ports shutting down. The ports of L.A. and Long Beach, well, they've ramped up their operations in order to get the supply chain moving again and get those products out all over the place. You've served the Southern California area, right? You're in Ohio right now.
I'm in Ohio right now. I actually drive for V3 Transportation. I'm an owner-operator, but we are leased onto them. And they actually have a couple of very good customers that are based out of Calexico and Thousand Oaks and all of the areas along there. So we are there quite often. And you mentioned, you know, in the introduction about living in your truck. My husband and I live in this truck. We go home maybe once a year for a week or two. And other than that, we're out here and we're facing it and we're battling it.
Priya, you mentioned that the drivers sometimes have a hard time during the holidays. I can imagine. They're on the road. They're away from families. I mean, Christy has her husband there, so that's good news. But how do the drivers that you spoke with feel about the holidays, you know, this time of year? We're just coming out of Christmas and New Year's.
I spoke to one driver. His name is JD. And, you know, he was really refreshingly outspoken about the mental health issues that many drivers face while on the road and how hard it can be for them during the holidays, you know, when they're seeing all of their friends and family get together and, you know, share drinks, and they see it on social media and they're kind of alone in the cab of their truck. So I think what's really wonderful is for people like him, for JD, cooking a really nice meal for himself kind of is a way of staving off that those feelings of loneliness.
It's kind of therapeutic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Christy, were you working during the holidays, you and your husband?
We were. We were actually out your way. We picked up in Reno, and we had to go down to Mississippi. And I can completely understand the sentiment of being alone. You know, my husband and I have a 15-year-old daughter that would have loved to see us. But again, trying to deal with this, you know, chain issue, the supply chain issue, we were out here, we were working, we were trying to alleviate it a little bit, as much as we can do our part.
Did you make anything special for the holidays?
My husband actually did a pork butt. He smoked a pork butt, and we nibbled on that as we were driving down the road.
Yeah, nibbled.
Yeah, nibbled. It's about the best you can do when you're in the hammer lane, you know, going down the highway. Well, you nibble.
Explain that. I mean, hammer, because you're on a schedule, right? You got to be somewhere. This itinerary, you got to. I mean, that's got to be tough trying to have a meal while you're doing that.
But then
you also get to rest too, right?
Well, over the holidays, we did not get to rest very much. We were on several loads back to back. And, you know, V3 is actually an expedite company. So we are the emergency crew of the trucking industry. So things that had to be there yesterday, that's what we're doing. Many times we are driving coast to coast in 40 hours. So we don't really have time to sit down and enjoy a meal together. We prep cook, we sit down on the weekend, we'll smoke a pork butt or a brisket or something like that, we stick it in the refrigerator, and we microwave it as we go.
40 hours from coast to coast.
Yep.
That sounds tiring and dangerous, too. I mean, do you guys alternate, you know, who drives,
yep,
who doesn't drive, who rests, things like that?
Yep. Yeah. We're only allowed to drive 11 hours per person and then rest for 10. And the next person takes over again. It's all part of team driving, but it does get tiring when you're, you know, trying to sleep driving down the road, but you get used to it. Like I said, we've been doing this for 16 years. It's part of life now.
I want to thank you for talking about it, and happy holidays to you. Bon appetit, I should say. Christy Burton, the truck driver based out of Ohio. New York Times reporter Priya Krishna, thank you to you both. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Got my chips cashed in and keep trucking like the dude out there. Together, more or less in line, just keep trucking. Oh, 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 oh.
You're listening to KCRW's Greater LA. Steve Chiotakis here. For a lot of folks, present host excluded, the new year brings the resolution to get in shape. Rock a fitter bod. Well, if you're tired of picking apart your own body in the mirror, check this out. A couple of artists with gallery shows in LA explore the human anatomy in their work. One artist does so seductively, surreally, and the other presents the body as functional but frail. Lindsay Preston Zappas is here to tell us more. Lindsay, of course, founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, welcome.
Hey, Steve.
Happy New Year to you.
Likewise. Happy New Year.
Tell me about these two artists. We're talking about Julia Phillips and Naveen Mahmood and their shows.
Yeah, so both of these shows are up in LA right now, and I know I always say this, but I really enjoy finding themes and connections across shows that are up at the same time. I find that really interesting. And both these artists really play with different elements and materials, so they're really mixing different things, ceramics, metal, glass, fabricated. They're working with auto body shops and different fabricators to produce their work. And then both of them really incorporate the body in different ways, but it's very different. So for Naveen Mahmood, whose show Foreplay 2 is up at M&B, she starts with children's play sets and toys, but then she kind of reconfigures them so that they become more sensual and bodily. And then for Julia Phillips, she starts with making ceramic body casts of her own body, and then she mixes those pieces with more industrial metal stands and tables. So they almost become like these unknown sci-fi type tools for some purpose, which we're not quite sure what that is. Really interesting.
Naveen Mahmood's pieces, Lindsay, are playground objects, correct? I mean, we're talking about slides and swings. But then we're mixing these other things, right? Like a tongue for a slide. You know what I'm saying? So it's like it's a juxtaposition that's innocent and surreal, but also a little unsettling when you're talking, especially when you're talking about children.
There's a line there for sure. But I think, you know, with Mahmood, for instance, there's this archway that she recreated from a child's playset, and she carves it into pink marble, which takes a long time, you know? And then the slide which comes down from the archway is this found plastic slide. But then she has the slide autobody painted with this glossy bubblegum pink paint. So it really becomes like a tongue, but it's not super sensual, overt. It's a very subtle juxtaposition. But, you know, I think there's definitely a bit of Freudian psychology there. It's like this triggering of childhood memories mixed with the body with the tongue. But she keeps it very bright and kind of poppy. And there's this found object element mixed with these really slow carved pieces, which to me has a very playful quality to it.
The other artist, Lindsay, Julia Phillips, uses a lot of ceramic and metal, which is, you know, spare. It's symmetrical. And, you know, I'm looking at an image of fake clavicle bones attached to a T-shaped stand. And, you know, it looks functional. There's even there's a microphone in the middle, of course, which speaks to me. Might be helpful in my studio. I mean, what's going on in this piece? We'll have a picture, by the way, on the website. So
yeah, definitely. So again, she starts with those body casts, right? So in this case, she's casting kind of like the clavicle area, but again, cropping it. So it's kind of hard to tell what you're looking at. And you know, I think with this there on either side of this metal stand, it's almost like this face-off between these two clavicle bones. And the microphone in the middle, I believe, is actually cast in metal, so it's not functional. Sorry to say, Steve, won't be in your studio. But there, you know, there's this like allusion with this piece, I think, to speaking and voice. But then there's an absence of that because there's no mouths, there's no heads. The microphone isn't functional. So I think a lot of her work includes the body, but then has this kind of psychological backbone to it. But she really leaves the work open for the viewers to kind of respond to and come up with their own kind of associations to what they're seeing.
I have way too many microphones anyway, so I can't help but wonder, Lindsay, if the body is a way into exploring the pandemic for these two artists, because here we are, we're going into year three of COVID. These times we're living through, there's a lot of illness and death, not a lot of freedom and fun. I mean, is that what's going on here, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a degree. I mean, of course, both of these artists were working this way before the pandemic, but I think it does bring on an extra kind of resonance. So I think for Mahmood, her work is all about sensuality and connection, which a lot of us have been missing, you know, over the pandemic. And Phillips is a little more overt with this. Her show is actually called Between Love and Loss. And she was really thinking about this kind of range of emotions that we've all felt over the pandemic. And how, you know, our emotional worlds are on a spectrum. It's not love or loss. It's, you know, between love and loss. So it's really about what exists between those two polarities. And I think it's a really beautiful and kind of fluid way to think about human existence and really allow for that fluidity of emotions.
You can check out Naveen Mahmood's show over at M&B Gallery. Julia Phillips' exhibition is over at Matthew Marks Gallery. Lindsay Preston Zappas, founder and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a conversation about California's last remaining nuclear power plant that's still operating. Diablo Canyon along the Central Coast is set to be shut down and decommissioned, but some say the state should keep nuclear power around, at least for a little while longer, while California works toward carbon-free energy production. That's tomorrow on GLA. Check us out online anytime, kcrw.com/greaterLA. And, of course, get the podcast there or get the podcast where you grab those podcasts. Nihar Patel, Crystal Voss, Captain Barnes, John Meek, Phil Richards, Amy Todd, Jody Adler, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl. I'll help put this evening's episode together. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your ears and your time tonight. Have a great night.